Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello, I'm Andrew Neil, and this is The Backstory, a series of in-depth interviews with people who have the power to shape events and to influence our understanding of them. In this episode, I'm joined by an activist who rose to prominence on social media, TV and radio as a vocal backer of Jeremy Corbyn. Ash Sarkar describes herself as a communist, which we discuss in the interview, and is a contributing editor at left-wing media site Novara Media. We also talk about her support for the former Labour leader, her relationship with the party now, and the tone of debate on Twitter, where she's faced terrible abuse. This is The Backstory from Tortoise. Ash Sarkar, you told Piers Morgan that you were, quote, literally a communist. What do you mean by communist?
What do I mean by communist? I think that means that everything that we need as humans to survive should be collectively owned, collectively managed, and that we should have access to them on the basis that we have a right to them rather than simply we've been born into a fortunate enough position to be able to afford them. I don't believe that markets are the most efficient method of distributing resources. And I think that one way in which we see that is with the climate crisis. And I think collective stewardship, particularly in this age of climate crisis, it looks like our way out.
Very few people opt to be communists these days. Why have you? What's propelled you in this direction? Who propelled you?
Who propelled me? I suppose it started when I read Black Skins, White Masks by Frantz Fanon. It was a book that my mum gave me, and she gave it to me because she wanted me to be able to understand life as a person of colour. And as you read Fanon, there are words like lumpenproletariat, and I didn't know where it came from. So I then got my hands on a copy of the Communist Manifesto. And I was a teenager at this time, so I must have been like 13, 14. And the impact that the Communist Manifesto had on me was exactly the one that Marx and Engels intended. It's this phenomenally rousing text. You know, it's very gothic, it's very dramatic. And I was like, my God, this makes a lot of sense. And then I got to uni and I started thinking about it, not just in an emotional way, but in a more rational way. And it made sense for me of why democracies are so weak in the face of capital, why our media is the way it is. This idea of base and superstructure I found really compelling as an analysis. It made sense to me on both an emotional level and as a way of making sense of the world I lived in.
It makes you, though, an outlier to have these views. Why now do so few people follow the route you have?
Well, the reason why so few people follow the route that I have is because communism was largely defeated by the time you get to the 1990s. One, you've got communist parties across the world either being massacred or discredited or forcibly broken up. Two, you've got the fall of the Soviet Union. Of course, that's a huge deal. And what you're left with are these sort of, you know, rump authoritarian states where it wouldn't be very nice to live. The exception, of course, being China, which is a sort of, you know, state capitalist bureaucracy in its own way. And so the utopianism and the romance of communism really, you know, was diminished by that. And in terms of being an outlier, I really don't mind that. I think it'd be very boring if everyone just had to judge their opinions according to where they think the crowd is.
So am I right in assuming from what you've said that you consider yourself a Marxist?
Would I consider myself a Marxist? In lots of ways, yes, but I think there's sometimes a tendency to look at Marx as something of a prophet, and you have to adhere to the revealed word of Marx and not think about the thinkers who took his work forward. Like I said, Franz Fanon is, of course, really important to me because he takes this idea of the lumpen proletariat, looks at it through the lens of colonialism. Gramsci, for me, is really important of how you make sense of what goes on in Western liberal democracies. Stuart Hall, then, for the cultural component.
The British philosopher.
Yeah, the British cultural thinker. So all of these thinkers, you trace it back to Marx, but they are doing things with Marx's thought that Marx doesn't get to grapple with.
Do I take it from what you said earlier, then, that your version of communism still involves the abolition of private property?
Well, I would say in terms of the abolition of private means of expropriating things that should be collectively owned, managed and stewarded. Not in terms of you can't own pieces of furniture, or you can't own your home.
You could own your home.
Yeah, I think that home ownership.
Even a big one.
Well, put it this way. I think that the demise of council house building, the introduction of right to buy, it's made the housing market worse for everybody. I think having a mixed housing economy would be quite a good thing. Ultimately, it means that home isn't what it is now, which is this sort of, bubble of asset price appreciation is doing something different. But I've got no beef with private ownership of a home if it means that homes are available to everybody.
But you said earlier that you wanted the collective provision of everything.
I'd say the collective stewardship of everything. And that doesn't mean that you don't have some level of private property. But ultimately, you've got the state being responsible for making sure that you've got the supply side covered, where private ownership isn't getting the job done.
Would the state own the media?
Would the state own the media? Now, this is something which I think is really important. I believe in state regulation in the sense of things like
that.
Ofcom, Impress. I really do believe in that. I believe in state-funded public service broadcast.
But we
state
have that too.
But state-controlled media? No.
But wouldn't the state own the media?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, you do have models of communism where you've got rooms for things like cooperatives, right? And Navarra Media, for instance, we're effectively a co-op. We've got a flat pay structure. If the, media organisation goes bust tomorrow, it's not, the two directors who get everything.
But you have that in a capitalist society.
We have that in a capitalist society. Where
is there a Navarra in a communist society?
Well, hopefully you'll see in 20 or 30 years.
But where has there been?
Well, the thing is that you have had, obviously not in, Soviet Russia, where you have an incredibly tightly controlled media environment, but you have had in, of course, Catalonia, you had a hugely radical independent press as well during the Spanish Civil War. You had some really interesting experiments with radical left-wing and in some ways hostile to the communist governance at the time in Bologna. You had the autonomous media, which is what we're modelled on. I'm not looking for top-down state control of everything. What I'm looking for is collective custodianship, which does involve things like cooperative ownership. I would be very uncomfortable with the state owning or controlling all media. But I also, and I think this is the, reverse back to you Uno card. I don't think in an environment where you've got over three quarters of the newspaper circulation being controlled by four billionaire families that we do have a free press. I think in some ways we've got an entirely constrained and restricted press.
To get to where you want to be with your kind of communism, do we have to go through the dictatorship of the proletariat?
I'm going to be honest with you, I don't know. I go through this.
So we might.
I go through this all the time where I think about democracy versus command and control, because I do believe there is something inherently emancipatory about the democratic process, democratic freedoms. That's where very much, I'm not a Leninist and I'm certainly not a Stalinist and I'm not a Trotskyist. I believe that the democratic process is important. But how you form that counterweight to capital and how you deal with the brute force of the capitalist state. I mean, this is, of course, stuff that Gramsci thinks about at length and is working through in the Prison Notebooks. My answer to that is a big old I don't know.
One of the things Marx advocated strongly was what he called revolutionary terror, which is part of the dictatorship of the proletariat. And most of those who formed governments based on Marx's doctrine were pretty keen on revolutionary terror. They carried it out. Lenin, Stalin, Mao, Pol Pot.
Well, of course, the origins of the phrase revolutionary terror come from the French Revolution and Robespierre. Have you read A Place of Greater Safety by Hilary Mantel?
No.
It's a beautiful novel, one of my favourite novels. And she's really grappling with this question of revolutionary terror, the desire to keep the revolution going in the face of all enemies and whatever, and also balancing against human life. And she's got a line which I think gets right to the heart of the contradiction, which is, what is one life in the grand scheme of things? Nothing. Of course, it means everything to its possessor. And for me, when it comes to this question of political violence, whether that is the revolutionary political violence that you're talking about in terms of Marx, whether you're talking about emancipatory political violence, which is what Frantz Fanon writes about in The Wretched of the Earth, for me, there is this stubborn idea of the sanctity of the human life, which I find hard to collapse or wave away in terms of, the revolutionary impulse.
But isn't that in conflict with all that we know about communist real life experience, where the sanctity of human life is often the last thing that matters?
But I would say that the sanctity of human life under the system we have is often the last thing that matters.
Really? Where are our gulags?
Where are our gulags? Well, we offshore them. I mean, this is the thing about capitalist societies, is that we can have our lovely European social democracies, but what goes on in Libya and at the borders of Fortress Europe is absolutely horrendous. When you look at the conditions for people working in coltan mines or coal mines or child labourers in India, what we do with global capitalism is we say, oh, we've got a lovely society here, but over there in the hinterland, in the periphery, it is absolutely, stained with blood.
So a textile factory in Sri Lanka, mm-hmm. paying very poor wages mm-hmm. and turning out clothes that we in the West buy mm-hmm. cheaply, that's the equivalent of a Stalinist gulag?
I'm not saying that they're equivalents. I'm saying that capitalism absolutely churns through human life. And if you want to measure body counts, and this is the interesting thing which Amartya Sen does in his work on famines, you end up with an astonishingly high death rate from famines in a democratic and liberal India after independence. Absolutely grotesque.
Higher than Stalin's treatment of the kulaks?
Well, that's the research that Amartya Sen comes out with. And Chomsky says if you apply the same methodology from the Black Book of Communism to India, you end up in one country alone with a higher death count.
But famines have happened in the non-communist world because of climate issues, because of government incompetence, because of over-farming, because of distribution issues. Famines have happened in communist regimes through direct, intentional economic policy.
But I think if you were, again, to
isn't that true?
Look at the colonial era, yes, but I would also say the same has happened in the non-communist world. If you talk to somebody from Ireland and you talk about the Great Hunger, they would say this was an intentional British policy.
But that's not true.
If you talk to people
but it's not true.
About the Bengal famine, well, yes, you had the turning away of certain grain ships. You only had relief coming in towards the end.
There's two different issues here. The causes of the potato farm famine in the 1840s and the British government's response to it, which everyone agrees was wholly inadequate. But the cause of it was not an intention. It was not intentional British government policy to starve the Irish to death.
But you did have the continuing exports of grain from Ireland during the potato blight. You also, and again, I know I'm talking about Amartya Sen
a
lot.
That's a response. It didn't cause it.
But in terms of the impact of deaths, then yes, it did cause the deaths, if not the blight itself.
I mean, given that every time people with your views come to power, and the result is the same, which is authoritarian dictatorships and economic squalor, why do you keep going back to the same thing?
Well, I would also differ with the idea that every time communists come to power, you do have economic squalor and authoritarianism.
Well, give me an example where that hasn't happened.
Kerala. So Kerala has had communist regional and local governments for absolute decades now. And compared to the rest of India in terms of its literacy, healthcare outcomes, it does an awful lot better.
But it's not a communist society.
But it's communist governments.
I understand that. Well, Bologna has had communist governments, but it's not a communist city.
Well, no, Bologna, I'd also say if you go back to the origins of Novara Media, we're very much against that tradition.
I understand that. But there's a world of difference between local government being run by communists within a capitalist or a non-communist nation state, and a communist nation state in which controls all the levers of power. Now, when that has happened, where's the success story?
But I'm saying that, one, there isn't one form of communism, right?
But I won't give me any.
This is a long and rich political tradition of which the Leninism and Maoism is just one part. And I do not associate myself with Mao. I do not associate myself with Lenin.
No, but I'm trying to find any example of where when a nation state has ended up following the route that you wanted to, that it's been a success.
The thing that I'm saying is that I think the capitalist society that we have, the trajectory that the world is on in terms of climate change in particular, I think that in 40 years' time, we'll be looking at that and go, well, why did we prioritize the market above all else? Why did we trust the market to get us out of this when we could have had collective ownership, collective stewardship, which would have allowed us levers, which would have solved this problem?
Except that it just results in poverty. Could I suggest that every country that moves to some form of market economy, and like your versions of communism, there are many versions of the market economy as well. Singapore is very different from Sweden, for example. Britain is different from America. France is certainly different from America. But they're all versions of the market economy. Every country that adopts that approach ends up with rising living standards, rising educational standards, less poverty, and rising per capita incomes. Every country. Whereas communism is the opposite.
So I take issue with that. I really do take issue with that. I think you're completely right to say that there are lots of different visions of a market economy. I think you're completely correct to say that.
But they all work better than communism, is the point I'm putting to you.
No, I'm not.
Give me examples of where a communist society has performed better than a market economy.
So here's one thing which I think, and again, this is about climate change.
I asked you the question.
No, I'm answering your question.
Where has there been a communist society that has operated better than a market economy?
Okay, I think that on certain metrics, Cuba has operated better. Now, it hasn't been on GDP, but if you want to look at healthcare outcomes, Cuba, compared to other Caribbean nations, has done much better, right? Much, much better. I know that you don't like the Kerala example, but for me, that is really important.
Kerala example is very interesting. I'm not arguing with that. I'm just saying that communists getting in charge of regional or local government is not the same as them running a nation state. That was my point there. I accept your example of
that. And then the third thing that I'd want to say, and this is about looking towards the future. I think that China is obviously a bad polluting country at present. But when you look at their ability to build infrastructure, when you look at things like high-speed rail, and then if you look at the pace at which the decarbonisation is going to happen, I think that they're in a much better position to decarbonise very quickly than, America.
They're building a new coal-fired power station every week.
I'm not saying that they're not bad polluters. They absolutely are.
But you just said they're leading to decarbonisation.
No, I'm saying if you look at their ability to decarbonise quickly.
But they're not.
Once they hit peak coal. No, I'm not saying it's happening now, but I'm saying their ability to do that, I think, is greater than America's ability to do that.
But America's already substantially decarbonised by moving from coal to gas.
But moving away from gas and getting rid of, fracking in Montana. American rail infrastructure may as well be in the 19th century.
You know, I understand that. America has major infrastructure problems, which Mr. Biden is, so far without huge success, trying to address. I don't understand how anybody, though your colleague at Novara has, could argue that China's in the vanguard of decarbonisation.
No, I'm not saying it's the vanguard of decarbonisation. I'm saying if you want to project 20, 30 years in the future where I think that every single nation state on the planet is going to go, oh my God, what have we been doing all this time? And you're going to have to pull the levers to wean yourself off fossil fuels very, very quickly. Which country is going to have the ability to do that rapidly? I think it will be China.
You weren't a member of the Labour Party, but you were part of the campaign which won Jeremy Corbyn the Labour leadership.
I wasn't part of the campaign which won him the Labour leadership.
Well, you were in favour of him becoming leader.
I'll be honest with you. At the time, I was a late adopter. At the time, I was sort of still a bit of like a sulky anarchist. And I sort of thought like, oh, the party political form is dead. And it took me a while to see the real opportunity. It wasn't really until 2017 itself shortly before the election, when I thought this thing's really important.
But you joined the Corbyn Labour Party.
I did.
And you hadn't been before. So there was some element of support there. Did you see him as a start on the road to communism, or just a Labour leader who was at least roughly on the same planet as you?
I saw him as a Labour leader who was capable of taking the concerns of my generation seriously. I didn't see him as a starter on the road to communism at all. And I didn't necessarily see him as being on the same planet as me in lots of ways, particularly to do with drugs policy, particularly to do with policing policy. We were really, really miles apart. But the reason why you'd see those pictures of him on Holloway Road and he'd be like surrounded by like, you know, just like utes. Do you know what I mean? Just like, you know, teenagers wearing North Face jackets. It's because he was speaking to their material conditions. And even though I am, you know, at heart a kind of, you know, disappointed utopian, you can't help but be moved by that. And that was what got me to join the party.
If Labour was going to choose a leader more to the left than traditional, was he the right left-winger to choose?
I don't know. I mean, because then you get into these counterfactuals where you could pick a different MP, for example, John McDonnell, and he would never have gotten to the ballot because he'd... I mean, am I allowed to curse on this?
A little bit, yes.
All right. He'd pissed off everybody in the party. You know,
that's quite mild.
You know, including everyone in, you know, the socialist campaign group as well. So I think that it could have only been Corbyn because of the unique set of circumstances that were there. And, you know, I've said this before, but Corbyn's greatest strengths were also his greatest weaknesses. He couldn't be anyone other than himself. And people were drawn to him because of that. But it also meant that when you had to be adaptive and reactive and responsive and to respond to things that maybe you think are unfair, he wasn't well placed to do any of those things.
Was there a time when you thought he could be Prime Minister?
Yeah.
When was that?
It was in the, you know, final run-up to the 2017 election. I thought this could happen.
Oh, you thought he might have won in 2017?
I thought this really could happen.
Helped by the quality of Theresa May's campaign.
Well, people say that a lot, but she added a lot to the Tories' vote share. It just wasn't distributed.
She lost
properly.
A lot to the Tory parliamentary representation.
She lost in seats, and that's because it was a crap campaign. But
that was my point.
And these are, you know, these were the warning signs for Corbyn, really, which is you looked at where she was stacking up votes. That was, you know, the crumbling red wall. But no, I thought, you know, it's almost painful to remember it because I just think, oh, what could have been
if he'd become Prime Minister. What do you think Britain's response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine would have been?
I think that in some ways it wouldn't have been that different. I think
you
that
think
the space,
he would have sent weapons from day one?
Not from day one. I think it would have been later down the line. But I think
he would have sent heavy armor.
I think that his you know, NATO skepticism would have been tempered by the nature of being in government.
He would have encouraged Finland and Sweden to join NATO.
I don't think it would have encouraged Finland or Sweden to join NATO. But then again, I don't think many of us would have thought that would be where we end up right, you know, from the beginning.
But the British government has encouraged. I mean, they've been in the vanguard of encouraging these two Scandinavian countries to join. I mean, even not in power, Mr. Corbyn hasn't been able to bring himself to say one kind word about President Zelensky.
Has he not? I mean, I've not been keeping up with his interviews, if I'm honest with you. I really haven't been.
He's attacked. He said he was against the invasion, but I mean, who isn't against the invasion?
He said, I don't know him, so I can't speak to him.
Exactly.
I mean, I think that's, again, that's a very Corbyn thing, which is, you know, there's an answer which is politic, and then there's the one that he wants to give, and he gives the one that he wants to give.
I mean, it's pretty hard to argue that our response would have been the same.
I don't. I genuinely think that in power, if when you're confronted with the day to day decisions of the deteriorating situation on the Ukrainian border, the scale of the Russian invasion, the devastation in Bucha and Mariupol, I think that ultimately the response would have been similar, in the same ballpark. purely because that's what the situation demands.
And yet he's been almost entirely silent about it.
I'm not his spokesperson. I don't know.
I understand that, but you did want him to be Prime Minister.
I did want him to be Prime Minister.
And you thought he could be. So that's why I'm asking you. The Labour left has taken control of the party twice in the past 70 years. Both times it's taken Labour to catastrophic defeats. Isn't it time to learn that lesson?
Well, the question I would pose back is, in Tony Blair's three back-to-back election victories, you know, the 1997 landslide, how many of those policy decisions are still with us, right? Sure Start got gutted. You know, the sort of Blairite social settlement, of which was, you know, a kind of like little bit more social democratic Thatcherism. You know, that's all gone. And so I'm not saying that I'm a particularly adept political strategist, because I don't think I am. But what I would say to the sort of, you know, moderate or right wing of the Labour Party is, why haven't you been able to entrench any of your social programme? Why was it so easy to wipe away?
The minimum wage is still there.
Minimum wage is still there.
The huge increases in spending in schools and hospitals that happened under Blair Brown.
But now look at what's happened to per pupil funding. You know, what's happened to the NHS. And one of the things which I think now interest rates are going up has been unforgivable.
But that's because you haven't won elections.
But no, in terms of what was happening under Blair, it's not like you had a massive council house building programme. It's not as if you had an attempt to do what... I mean, Margaret Thatcher, I think, is, along with Clement Attlee, the two most visionary prime ministers that we've ever had.
Well, they were the two most transformative peacetime
exactly.
prime ministers.
And in the same way, we are still living with remnants of Attlee's Britain. I think we are living in Thatcher's Britain in a huge way.
Well, we have
way.
The welfare state.
Right, we have the welfare
and
state.
And we have the NHS.
What's left of it? What's left
and
of it?
Well, we spend almost $200 billion a year on it, so there's a fair bit left of it.
What Thatcher understood, and this is what Blair didn't understand, and this is what I think Corbyn was trying to do. So she famously said, economics is the method, the object is to change the soul. She created an economic environment which pumped out Tory voters, all right? That was what Right to Buy was about. That's what the attacks on the unions were about, the demise of heavy industry. It pumped out Tory voters. Blair, with his back-to-back election victories, didn't do that, right? He didn't create those kind of economic machines which create Labour voters. And I genuinely believe that if even just a bit of that 2017 manifesto, so the commitments on council housing, education spending, empowering trade unions again, I think if those things had happened, I think they would have been comparable, perhaps not on the scale, but comparable on the same planet as the scale of Thatcher's changes, which meant we would have been with them for a really long time.
But voters aren't forever. Political parties don't get to own voters forever. And although Blair did create a huge coalition to produce two landslides plus a comfortable victory third time, and Thatcher did reconfigure the way people voted during her time, millions of people who voted for Margaret Thatcher voted for Tony Blair.
And that's because, Tony Blair, if you're my honest opinion, I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, the first Labour leader in decades also happened, to end up being the godfather to one of Rupert Murdoch's children, right? He had to make a deal with an incredibly right-wing media landscape. Before that, when you had Labour prime ministers, it was when the Daily Mirror was the biggest selling newspaper in this country. The media environment was totally different. You know, made a bit of a deal with the devil. He says, look, don't go for us too hard. There are certain things we're not going to touch, and it's not going to be hugely different to when the Conservatives were in power. And they go, okay, you know, that's what we're going to do. I'm not saying that parties own voters, far from it. I'm saying that a party which is serious about its longevity and its legacy understands that the policies that you introduce have to, you know, produce the electorate that is most conducive to you winning power again. And I think that Tony Blair, for all of his vision and his strategy, didn't do that.
Is there a parliamentary route to your kind of communism?
Probably not. Probably not. I don't know what the route is. And I'm saying this with in.
Well, that was my next question. If it's not a parliamentary route, what is it?
I absolutely do not know. I do not know. And there have, of course, been different radical experiments. You've had the Paris Commune, you've had the autonomists, you've had the attempt to sort of build, you know, autonomous small communities. You've got the thing which, you know, my colleague Aaron Bastani writes about, which is sort of going back to Marx's first principles and saying, look, technological change is going to bring this thing. I don't know what it is, and I don't pretend to either.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're with Navarra, the website of, how would I describe it? Left-wing activism? I mean, it's journalism with a purpose. It's journalism that you hope will change things.
So is the Daily Mail.
Yeah, that may be a good or a bad comparison. I'll leave you to make that. Is that a fair description of it?
I'd say we're left-wing. I wouldn't necessarily call ourselves activists, though we do try and cover social movements and activism, because that's something which is often neglected in legacy media outlets. I mean, I know I've mentioned his name once already, but I sometimes joke that we're Rupert Murdoch ambition without Rupert Murdoch budget, because the way Rupert Murdoch was like, this is a generation, I'm going to be responsive to you, I'm going to be moulded by you and mould you, and it was, you know, boomers and older Generation Xs. We sort of see ourselves as being that, but for broke people.
Are you making progress, or are you really on the wilder fringes?
I would say that as a media organisation, we're definitely making progress, and I can see that happening in terms of being able to have an entirely donation and subscription funded organization. We don't require injections of venture capital like Vice Media. You know, we don't have a paywall.
You haven't got a big bankroller behind you.
So we've got 6,000 paying supporters.
Right.
And we have over 200,000 YouTube subscribers to the channel. And we have, you know, something like 2 million, you know, views per month.
So the funding is atomized. It's so not coming from a Mr. or a Miss Big.
No, I wish it was. No, it's from,
well, maybe,
you know,
after the people hear this, you may
Mr. and Mrs. You know, we encourage people to give the equivalent of 1 hour of their wage per month. But
right.
But whatever they can is fine. So it's not right. Huge donations.
And you're able to survive on that.
And we've been able to grow on that.
And grow on it too.
And our best period of growth was actually post-Corbyn during the pandemic, because my colleague Michael Walker took his live streaming show to three nights a week We nickname him the sober judge. He's very, you know, adept at sort of processing large amounts of information and conveying it in a way which helps people find their way through it. And, you know, young people are an underserved audience when it comes to news and current affairs media. You know, they really, really are.
And not many of them watch the mainstream news and current affairs.
Yeah, and that's because, you know, their viewing habits are different, they're in different places, but also because they don't see their reality being represented necessarily.
Twitter, you use it quite a lot. You use it a lot even though you attract a lot of personal abuse. None of it merited, and some of it quite horrific. Is it water off a duck's back, or actually does it get you down at times?
I don't think that the human brain is designed to absorb that much violence and that much violent imagery. I also think that you have to be realistic and say, if you think that social media is a worthwhile space of contestation, that is what's going to happen. So I think you've got to do two things. One is you preserve as much of your own mental well-being as you can.
Which is difficult when you get the abuse you're getting.
I'm really lucky in terms of the people I've got around me. I've got a group of friends.
You have a support system.
Well, yeah, they're just really good at like taking my phone off me and just being like, just stop. Like, instead, why don't you watch, you know, Tottenham Hotspur get
you can be
by
quite,
Chelsea or make you feel better?
I mean, you and I don't. I perfectly understand this. It's not a criticism at all. It's understand, but you can be quite spiky yourself.
Yeah.
When and I guess that winds them up even more.
I like repartee.
Repartee is great. There's no problem with that at all. And repartee also implies sometimes a bit of humour. A lot of the time, you're dealing with anything but humour. You're dealing with dark, evil minds.
I mean, where it's frightening is where you think it's going to have a real-world expression. And there have been times where I've been chased by the far right, where...
What, physically chased?
Yeah, like physically chased. There have been times where I've seen a tweet where somebody was standing behind me in the queue for a supermarket and was like, oh, should I punch her in the back of the head? And there are
so it has
where,
a real world manifestation.
Yeah, it does. But that's... I don't mean this in a dismissive way because it's horrible and it shouldn't happen, but that's the name of the game. And ultimately, the thing that I'm doing is I'm being paid. I make a living to advance a left-wing perspective, and I'm part of a movement of people who are doing that for free. And so I think that while you can say, this really sucks, it's horrible, and I wish it didn't happen, I think that it can get a bit, you know, the world's tiniest violin, where you start going, oh my God, I'm such a victim. No, ultimately, I have a privileged position within a movement, and I think you have to take that seriously.
What do you think, since you're on the receiving end of it, what do you think makes people so horrible on social media? Is it anonymity? Does that help?
No, I mean, I think that the studies done of it, which, you know, for instance, around the Euros finals exit, which showed that the majority of people sending racist abuse to the three players who missed their penalties, they did so under their real names. So I don't think
they did.
They did. So I don't think that anonymity is necessarily.
Well, then we must know where they live.
Well, I'm going to be like, what'd you say about my boy Bukayo Saka? The one time you'll ever see me standing up for an Arsenal.
So it's not all anonymous, is what you say.
Yeah. So it's not all anonymous. I think there's a really good book about this called The Twittering Machine by Richard C. Anymore. And one of the things that he talks about is that it has an addictive structure, right? So it is literally modelled to give your brain these little dopamine hits. It fosters a neurotic attachment, and all of us are in some way involved in it. And I use all of us quite deliberately because while me and you might not be the most, you know, egregious abusers of Twitter crack, we are also addicts who are trying to distance ourselves from the worst part.
But it can also drag you down in the sense that when, and I think you're of the same frame of mind, that if someone is really egregiously rude to you or unpleasant, you are of a mind just to whack them back.
I mean, I think that you're always going... I mean, it's almost like the same rules as a fist fight, right? Whoever wins a fist fight is whoever's got the greatest capacity for violence, right? And who doesn't care how much they're getting hurt as long as they're hurting the other person. And ultimately, in a Twitter slanging match, that's the rule as well. And so you've got to have a cutoff in your own head of how far you're going to go.
Because it's a fight you can't win.
Right, because it's a fight that you're not willing to win.
That, yes.
Right, and I think that's a different thing. For me, I think repartee is one thing. I really like having a clap back, and it's because I grew up listening to pirate radio. So pirate radio, it was all about clashing and having the last word and saying something witty. And I'm just like, I can't help it. I want to do this thing again. But you ultimately have to draw a line. You go like, this isn't an argument which anyone is going to win in a meaningful sense. Ultimately, whoever will prevail is the person who's able to inflict the most damage to the other, because they don't mind how much they're damaging themselves.
And what next for Ash Sarkar?
A nap.
You mean after this interview?
Oh my God. A Valium, please.
You're hugely active. You have a strong view of the way the world should be. You promote that view with an articulate way of doing it. But you are in the political wilderness. Are you content to stay there?
I think that my job has changed, and I'm glad that it has changed. I think between 2017 and 2019, because I really wanted this thing to happen, right? I wanted council housing. I wanted an end to homelessness. I wanted to stop seeing the food bank that's around the corner from my house. I wanted to stop seeing that queue get longer every day. That I thought my job was just like, oh my God, get this thing over the line. And now there isn't a project of that nature. And now I think what my job is, and in some ways I'm really grateful that I have the opportunity to do so, is just take a step back and go, okay, so what's really going on? So I'm working on a book at the moment, and it's called Minority Rule. And it's looking at how culture wars are an outgrowth of what's happened to media over the last 40 years, what's happened to class composition over the last 40 years, and then going, so what's going on behind that? What actually is going on with class? What actually is going on with the economic settlement which shapes our society? And it's a luxury to be able to do that. It's a luxury to be able to go, I am going to just step back and do a vibe check of British politics and society. And I think that that's my job. Afterwards, I don't know. I'm really bad at making future plans and sticking to them. I just sort of see where I end up and go, okay.
Hi, Sarkar, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Tortoise members and subscribers to Tortoise Plus on Apple Podcasts can hear my reflections on that conversation in a bonus episode called Inside the Interview, which comes out every Friday during this series. You can join our newsroom for £50 a year by going to tortoisemedia.com/Andrew and entering the code AndrewNeil50. That's 50, all one word. This episode was mixed by Studio Klong with original music by Tom Kinsella. The executive producer of The Backstory is Lewis Vickers. Thanks for listening.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.